This podcast is brought to you by Writers' Centre Norwich and the British Council, and was recorded at the first International Literature Showcase in Norwich, UNESCO City of Literature, in March 2015.
Welcome to our attendees here in the audience and also online through the live streaming. My name is Chris Gribble, the Chief Executive at Writers' Centre Norwich. It's a pleasure again to be with you today and to introduce you to Alex Preston. Now, you will notice immediately that Alex Preston is only Alex Preston and not also Daria Osman. Unfortunately, Daria isn't able to join us today, so in his absence, we have slightly more of Alex. Which I think
and
that.
More of Chris,
and more of me, which.
One can't complain about.
That is arguable. However, the former proposition isn't. Alex is an author, journalist, academic, and critic. He first came to Norwich, I think, was it about 5-6 years ago, when his first novel was published, This Bleeding City, which was a hugely timely as well as a very invigorating depiction of a mid-crisis city, capitalist system, at the time when we were all thinking about pretty much that all of the time. Alex has since gone on, sort of in an equally timely fashion, although probably not consciously, to write about, in the Revelations, to write about the rise of the belief industry, almost, if you can. I think it is an industry in many respects, and what that does to friendships and individuals. And with his third novel, which he'll be reading from today, he jumps back in a different direction, taking us to interwar Italy. We started on Wednesday night with Renaissance Italy and Ali Smith, and now, no pressure, we have pre-interwar Italy with In Love and War. Alex's work is characterised by, in a similar way to the, how Ali discussed, a real close attention to research, but with that, any lingering weight of that research left well and truly behind when the writing is completed. It's a real pleasure to welcome him here today, and I'd like to ask you to start the proceedings by reading.
Thank you very much indeed. It's so lovely to be here in Norwich. I feel that this is kind of every writer's spiritual home now, thanks to the work of Chris and his colleagues. I'm going to read a little bit from the beginning of the book, and then I'm going to read a little bit at the end. Florence. The pilot turns in his seat and winks, as if the flight is a secret or a first. Esmond repeats the word in his mind and releases a shiver. He is the only passenger. The biplane belongs to Grandi, the ambassador, and sits at a steep angle to the ground, forcing him into a tilt. Out of the window is the long body of Croydon Aerodrome, and in front of it, his family. Except for his sister Anna's white organdy, they are uniformed in black, as though for a funeral. The plane pulses towards the main runway. Esmond presses a hand, and then his face, to the throbbing glass, and sees his father raise his good arm. For a moment, he thinks it's a wave. Then his mother raises hers. A steely thrust, up and forward, and he realises they are saluting and sinks back into his seat. I apologise for the position in which you find yourself. The pilot leans over a tasselled shoulder, his smile Italian, his moustache so thin that it might be inked on. That's all right, Esmond says. I feel like I'm in an H.G. Wells. The pilot laughs. A ship to the stars. At the runway's mouth, the noise from the engines drops. The pilot raises the window beside him, checks the dials on the dashboard and straightens his cap. Andiamo, he says. Esmond looks between the tapering wings towards his father. Sir Lionel's face is ripe and red above the black tunic, chest barreled. His empty sleeve is pinned alongside campaign ribbons, the 1415 star, the victory medal. He catches Esmond's eye and smiles with an unconvinced detachment, like a man inspecting the menu in a failing French restaurant. Lady Ursula is taller than her husband. Her own black shirt worn with gabardine slacks. Her hair lifts in a spring gust as she stands there, saluting, hard set in face powder. She glances down at Rudyard, his brother, crouched with a Jack Russell, and says something sharp, then back at the plane. Your sister is a little beautiful, the pilot says. Esmond laughs. Yes, just a little. A handsome family. A green light winks on the control tower. You are ready? The plane gives a breathy roar and bounds down the runway, throwing Esmond into his seat. He has to crane his neck to keep his eyes on Rudyard, who is up and waving, Anna pale beside him, arms lifted. His parents hold their salutes, as if posing for posthumous statues. A schoolboyish whoop. He is no longer canted back, but upright, weightless. He looks down at his family, four faces turned towards him, and feels knots of love and duty stretch and give. As the plane rises, he sees the white fragment of his sister between wisps of cloud and feels an ache at the thought of leaving her with her illness, with their parents. He turns towards the yellow smear above London, the vastness of the sky stretching away to the south, and again, a low whoop. He fingers the collar of his black tunic. His father had insisted he travel in full British Union get-up, and undoes his seatbelt. It is warmer in the plane than he'd imagined. He taps out and lights a cigarette from a soft black packet bearing the party's lightning fork. The engines seem quieter up here in the wide air, and he can hear the wind against the fuselage, the beat of first one propeller, then the other, until they level out and the sound becomes a continuous, soothing hum. "You'll enjoy the Dragon Rapide," Moseley had said. "Flying and fascism have a long history and a long future together." Sunlight slants into the cabin, thickened by his smoke. A buffeting gust, and the plane gives a lurch, and he feels the delicious precariousness beneath him and realizes he hasn't thought of Philip or Cambridge for an hour or more. Anna had pressed something into his hand in the aerodrome, a folded sheet of paper smudged with fingerprints. It sits on the seat beside him now with the wireless operator's handbook. He picks up the paper and unfolds a portrait of himself in gouache, Anna Lowndes looped at the bottom. His blonde hair is side-parted above wide, long-lashed eyes. His lips are turned down mournfully, cheeks flush. It is a good likeness, he thinks, if a little tragic and big-eared. She has drawn a man, given him something to grow into. A bump, and the plane banks to the left. Lim! The pilot shouts, nodding down to the airfield below. They circle the control tower once, and a green light flashes greeting. A waggle of the wings, and they are over a cricket ground, dunes, a gaudy litter of bathing huts strung out in pink, yellow and turquoise along the promenade. The channel turns in shelves from teal to the deepest blue, and he realises England has gone. He presses his fist to his mouth and stares ahead, over the pilot's shoulder, to Europe. The mountains fall as they'd risen, and soon give on to rolling farmland, lakes like spilt mercury, red-roofed towns. "Your new home," the pilot shouts. Esmond sees the aeroplane's shadow, which really is like a dragon, harrying the path of a river. He lights a cigarette and presses his cheek against the glass. "Could I have one?" the pilot calls back, not turning this time. "Please?" Esmond looks at the pack in his hand and thinks about throwing it, then pulls himself off, up. Excuse me, that's a terrible clangor. Pulls himself up. That would be a wholly different kind of book. Thank God this isn't going out into 20 million homes as we speak. The next word was off. I mean, it wasn't... Jesus!
Just leave it.
Sorry. Right, go on. Thinks about throwing it, then pulls himself up off kilter until he's in the seat behind the cockpit. He leans over and places a cigarette between the pilot's lips. "Why do you come to Italy? You are a politician, yes?" "Not precisely," Esmond says, lighting a fag for himself. "My father's Lionel Lowndes, of the British Union. With Moseley, I read the English Mail, for your language, you understand." "That's right. So you're a fascist, like your new hosts?" "I suppose so. I'm setting up a wireless station for the British Union, a commercial enterprise." The last, direct from the mouth of Moseley, who'd kneaded Esmond's shoulder each time he'd said it. "Bravo," the pilot says. "It's the first time for me, away like this." "In Florence, you are lucky. a city of artists, politicians, and Englishmen. You are all three, I think. Perhaps. Esmond picks up the wireless operator's handbook and begins to read about sine waves and resonators, capacitors and inductors. He is half nodding in the worn cabin when the pilot's voice comes as if through the doors of a dream. "Storm over Florence," he says, showing Esmond his frown. "Hard landing." Esmond shrugs, having given himself up to fate. The dark clouds paint the whole depth of the sky ahead. Forks of lightning jag downwards, burning themselves out on his eyes. They stare into the clouds, and it is as if night has fallen. Rain thrashes the windows, obscuring even the wings, and the aeroplane bobs and yaws, plywood shuddering in the wind, engines muffled. The pilot sends them first one way, then another, trying to cut a path through the storm. Esmond puts his hands behind his head, leans back in his seat, and, surprising himself even as it happens, he falls asleep. He dreams of a Juliet balcony, looking over terracotta roofs towards a dome. His enemy is beside him, torturer's hands folded over the rail. Esmond takes a handful of the coarse black twill of his enemy's shirt, pulls him over the balcony and into the air. In a slow moment, he lets go of the shirt and sees his father and Mosley swinging him between them as a child, his father's good arm full of strength, Mosley's fingers dry and certain. "Here we go, bend a bow, shoot a pigeon and off we go." They lift him squealing, stomachless, into the sunshine. Again, he feels he is rising, still rising into the pale evening. Then he begins to fall, and he hears his enemy's screams, and he sees the ground rushing up to meet them. He senses death, impossible in dreams, and opens his eyes very wide. "Difficult," the pilot shouts, stubbing his cigarette on the inside of the window. They're coming in fast over the runway, yawing horribly, and the screaming is the baying of the wind. A distant green light through the swirling rain, then they drop, bounce once on the ground, are airborne again, and careening through the night. The wheels hit the tarmac once more, a blast of rubber, and Esmond's box of books launches into the air and bursts against the cabin roof. He is beamed by a copy of Hamsun's Hunger. The back wheel falls to earth with a clunk, and Esmond lands hard in his seat, Kipling and Henry James in theirs. The plane comes to a skidding halt, the pilot's shoulders heaving. Esmond sits there for a while, breathing the fusty air of the cabin, the sharp tang of fuel. "Florence?" he says. The pilot nods. "Firenze." As he falls, Esmond doesn't think of Bruno or Carita falling with him. He doesn't think of Elio or what remains of him. He doesn't think of Alessandro in the graveyard beside the great synagogue, or Maria Luigia buried in the cemetery at San Miniato. He doesn't think of tatters running at his heels along the cypress-lined mule tracks of Bello Sguardo, or the doggy Cairn by the swimming pool. He doesn't think of Philip lying in a grave in the blushing heights above Barcelona. He doesn't think about Anna. He doesn't think about Rudyard, who is not more than 100 miles away, marching towards Florence. He doesn't think of Gerald or Fiamma. He doesn't even think of Ada, who is, however, thinking of him. Under a sky of fast-moving, sulphurous clouds, she sits and pictures him, and it makes her smile, the shape of his face in her mind. Instead, as he falls, he remembers, aged 7 or 8, when a dog had died at Aston Magna. It was a stable dog, not one of the hounds, and his father had refused to call the vet. She didn't even have a name. She'd given birth to 3 healthy pups who were now with cook in the kitchen, sucking milk from plump fingers. One of the pups was still inside her, though, and after dragging herself around the yard on her hunkers for an hour, straining every so often, groaning after the stable lads had tired of their attempts to fish the dead, sack-wrapped pup out of her, she'd crawled up to Esmond's room to die. He'd sat with her all night, the shuddering weight of her in his arms, her head on his shoulder, sour breath in his ear, until finally she'd stopped breathing. He sat with her a while longer, and then carried her out into the pale morning and buried her in his mother's rose garden, beneath a crowned Princess Margareta. He was astonished by the lightness of her body, as if life were substantial. Back in the warmth of the house, he went into the kitchen where Cook was still sitting in a deep armchair, the silky knot of puppies in her lap cooing a gentle song to them. He'd said nothing, but sat on the arm of the chair and watched, wonderstruck, as the new lives writhed and shivered. He even has time, on his journey to the hard earth, to marvel at the workings of the mind, where this forgotten image from his youth has arrived unbidden and filled his heart with sorrow and with joy. And now, as if the dog, whose mottled fur and wet nose he can see with extraordinary clarity there beside him, has unblocked some obstruction, a flood of love comes. Anna speaking gentle words in his ear, Philip in the foliage at Cambridge, the sound of rain on leaves, Fiamma and Gerald in the island-studded river. He pictures Douglas and Aureoli, Moseley and his father swinging him between them as a child, his mother burning books in a field, and he loves them all. Now the parade of figures wisps across the cyclorama of his mind, the unfinished symphony loud around them, the city's angels peeling themselves from the bridges and loggias. St. John and Mary Magdalene dance, wild-eyed, sweeping their tattered robes about them, Mary's hair like a russet river. An ardour, and he swells at the thought of her. And the last thing he does before the ground rushes up is to send arrowing towards her everything that is left of his strength. As he dies, he realises that the last few months of his life have been spent chasing after the wrong thing, his father's idea of pluck. But he knows he has done enough, and that it doesn't matter. Caritas hits the ground first, a wet thud. Esmond feels himself turn inside himself and can now see the largeness of the palpitating earth, the depth of human love, the stars in the firmament, ardour singing gently into the sulphurous sky. As he draws his last breath, he realises that this is the thing. This is joy and courage and hope, ardour. A feeling of extraordinary peace washes over him. A feeling of bliss, ardour, blackness.
Wonderful. Thank
still,
you very
still
much.
Still chokes me up a little bit. Jesus,
I'm not surprised. They're a fantastic contrast, those two pieces.
Yes, especially given the unintended humour in the first part.
Let's just call it a learning moment.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm never going to make that mistake again, but I will always give a little inward chuckle when I read that passage.
You may never have to read that passage out again.
Well, maybe.
Anyway, cities, times is where I wanted to start. I very much identified you with contemporary London, primarily because that's where large parts of both of your previous novels were set. And your interest in the social sort of fabric of the city, it seemed sort of entirely thoroughgoing. So I was a little surprised when all of a sudden In Love and War came along and we were in a different country, in a different city, in a different time. What took you there?
Yeah, I mean, it's always interesting, isn't it, that, I mean, I love my publishers dearly, but they had said to me, right, we need another London novel. And of course, now this has come out and done very well. They're telling me we need another, historical novel set in Italy. So, they're imaginative people. I'm sure it's only...
Did they really say it?
They really did say that. And, because you're absolutely right that I had written these books about a generation in London, about the experiences of the people around me, about what it was to come to make that kind of, archetypal journey from the country to the city and the struggles, the joys, the tragedies that beset these young people. But I wanted to do something totally different. And really, I wanted to write a non-fiction book. I thought that I wanted to write something about Italy. I'd spent a lot of my youth in Italy. And I went to Florence, and I met a couple of people who had been young teenagers, I guess, during the war, one of whom had been a black shirt, one of whom had been a member of the resistance, and I interviewed these people, and I thought, right, there are all these wonderful stories here. I must write this in the form of a non-fiction book. These are extraordinary tales that deserve to be told. And of course, what I hadn't realized, but what I realized as soon as I sat down and tried to write it non-fictionally, is that there is no better vehicle into the lives of others, into the minds of others, into history than the novel. So, you know, very swiftly I was converted from the path of nonfiction. But I tried to keep so much of that, of the truth. And it is a novel that is, you know, very consciously trying to stick to the historical framework. All of the characters apart from the hero are historical figures. And, you know, so yes, it was something different, and you know, the next novel is not going to be a historical novel set in the Second World War in Italy. I felt that as a writer, I wanted to ask new questions of myself, that I wanted to see whether this was something I could do. I also read, when it first came out in France, I read HHHH by Laurent Binet, which was a novel that absolutely resonated with me, not only because it's brilliant in so many ways, but also because I think that it was saying to me, you can write a historical novel and yet you can say something, firstly, about literature generally, which was, again, something I tried to do here, but also that every historical novel needs to be a novel not only about the period of history, but about the present. And I wanted to say something about fascism in Europe at the moment. I wanted to say something about what happens in periods of economic crisis, when you get this kind of hardening of people's kind of political spirits that we are seeing going on around us, you know, in this country and all over Europe. And so I was very, very keen as I was writing it that it wasn't some, you know, delightful escape into the period, but actually it tried to say something about the now as well.
And there's the sort of clear through line, if you like, the economic analysis and the personal impact that you showed in the first novel and the spiritual search of the second novel, and again the wider social impact of these particular economic and political conditions on the individuals. That's what keeps you as a writer attracted and attached to your characters and your stories.
Yeah, I mean, I think that certainly characters in novels should never just be vectors. I never want to see them as merely representative, but I also think that, you know, there is, you know, the novel is a political form. The writing a novel is a democratic act, and I felt that I did have a kind of, you know, not something as distinct as a message, but there was something I wanted to say with this book. And, you know, somebody said the wisdom of the novel is the wisdom of uncertainty, and I think that one of the things I felt about this book was that I was finding my way into the subject and kind of working out my stance on where we were as I wrote it. And you know, I don't know whether I come to any firm conclusions at the end, but every novel should be a learning experience for the author as much as for the reader.
And you and your publishers are now convinced and trust you enough to go and do whatever you like?
Well, I don't know. We are currently agreeing terms of the next novel, so I'm not going to speak for them so swiftly. But, you know, again, I'm so pleased that it has been received as it has, because it was very risky for me and it could have been a total catastrophe. It's the most I've ever worked, it's the most I've ever cared about anything other than, you know, children, family, etc. I always have to put in those caveats, otherwise my wife picks me up on it and tweets her anger. Very modern family, yes. Soon my children will be doing the same. But yeah, you know, it was risky, but I think one needs to take these risks.
Kind of a forward-looking question. You mentioned when we were talking earlier that you're not heading back to Italy, the war Italy. You're going to Poland and Krakow next. Could you tell us a little bit about what's sort of exercising you and how this novel is taking place?
Krakow and Paris, not only because they're two wonderful cities, this is one of those, do you know what, I was actually last night, it seems like an age ago, but only because of the eclipse and all of the, but last night I was having a conversation with a young novelist who is writing I think cli-fi is the term for it, so, you know, sci-fi based on climate change.
I thought it was going to be Clyde in North Norfolk.
No, okay. a distinct genre has cropped up in North Norfolk science fiction. No. And she's a lovely, lovely writer, and I think it's going to be a wonderful book. But I said, so tell me a bit about it. And she said, well, I can't really. And I was like, oh. And she said, well, because, you know, it's a very distinctive idea. Like, you know, I'd want you to sign something. And I feel a little bit about that, like that about my next novel, but not for the, not for those kind of reasons, but largely because it is doing some quite interesting things about where fact and fiction overlap. And it is a sort of fictionalized biography of somebody who has been very important in my life, my godmother, who lives in Krakow, who was... once a very, very powerful figure in the world of fashion, who had these extraordinary kind of peaks and troughs of her existence, and who I have lived with, or I lived with in Paris. And so it's a little bit, you know, reality hunger, a little bit David Shields-ish. It's very been wonderful. I mean, I was out in Krakow in October with her, researching the novel, but also just spending time out there. And again, it, you know, you talked at the beginning about cities. I think I am a writer of cities, mm-hmm. and Krakow and Paris are two places where I feel incredibly at home. Mm. And I think that's maybe one of the things we're doing, trying to write ourselves the home we feel we never had. You know, that I grew up in Worthing, which is, for those of you from outside of the UK, just a void. I'm sure we don't have any Worthingites in here.
Watching on the internet, though.
Yes, exactly. Well, no, there's already, you know, because the first novel was, some of it was set in Worthing, so I'm already persona non grata there. You know, where Thomas Wolfe said you can never go home, I really can never go home because I'll be hit. Yes. Anyway, so yeah, the new novel is just beginning to take shape, and is very exciting. It's the best part of any novel is just before you write the first word, and then it's about trying to maintain the kind of platonic ideal for as long as possible before you diverge from what you mean to do.
Fantastic. Well, I will really look forward to seeing that in whenever it appears, in 2 years.
20 years time.
It's good to start positively. Excellent. I'd just like to take this opportunity to thank you once more for coming and reading for us. And ladies and gentlemen, Alex Preston.
Thank you so much indeed.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the International Literature Showcase. Find out more about all of our showcase events and find new podcasts at internationalliteratureshowcase.org.uk.